This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome to the Bike Radar podcast, brought to you by the team behind BikeRadar.com, Cycling Plus, and MBUK magazines. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe. And if you can do so, leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps us reach other cyclists like you.
Hello and welcome to the Bike Radar podcast. I'm Jack Luke, and today I am joined by former pro rider turned multi-terrain ultra-endurance rider, Molly Weaver. Molly turned pro in 2015, riding for Matrix Fitness Pro Cycling, wrapping up her pro road career in 2018, riding for Trek Drops, and probably one of our only guests ever to have her own Wikipedia page. A great flex to start things off. Since then, Molly's gone on to become something of a legend in the ultra-endurance scene, competing in this year's Atlas Mountain Race, Trans-Pyrenees, the GB Divide, the Highland Trail 550, and more. And at the time of recording, she also holds no fewer than 8 UK FKTs, and that will be the subject of today's podcast. More on that in a second. We're also joined by senior videographer Robin Furtado, pretty much the only member of the team with the necessary experience to talk with authority about what it takes to race an ultra. Robin raced the inaugural Bright Midnight, a 1,000-kilometre gravel race in Norway, and wrote an excellent piece about the adventures, revealing, among other things, that cucumbers make the finest cycling food. That's linked in the podcast description. It's a really, really good listen. But yes, today we'll be discussing the phenomena that is the FKT, an increasingly popular alternative to racing that's taking the cycling world by storm. And who better to talk about FKTs than the custodian of fastest known times UK, Molly. Before we dive straight in, Molly, how are you doing today? You're just off the back of Atlas Mountain Race. Give us the goss.
I'm good, thanks. That's about the goss. I'm just off the back, but I've also, I think it's like 3 weeks since now, and I've done almost nothing. So I'm in that bit where you're trying to get back into riding. But no, it was epic.
Trying to re-love bikes.
Yeah, and you really want that like rebound from an ultra, but it takes quite a long time. So you get back and like, how have I got worse? But yeah, I feel like I'm getting into that bit where hopefully I'll pick things back up again.
Just before we go off from the Atlas Mountain Race, give us the key stats on the Atlas Mountain Race for those that aren't familiar with it.
So it's 1,300 kilometres and a bit of change. And you kind of go through the High Atlas in Morocco into the Anti-Atlas, and then you head towards the coast. Many tens of thousands of metres of climbing. I never actually looked at that because ignorance is bliss sometimes. And yeah, it took me 5 days and a bit.
Only 5 days. Oh my gosh.
You are a monster.
Didn't you get ill halfway through it?
Yeah, it was about a day longer than I'd hoped it would take me, but I stopped at checkpoint two, about roughly halfway. I stopped there for a whole day. So I think I stopped 15 hours or something.
Oh my God.
So I lost quite a chunk of time resting and then deciding what to do.
God, what are you averaging every day then? That's insane.
Oh, I have no idea. I've not looked at a single stat from it. Once it was done, I just closed it off and I was like, cool, that's done. It is like it's a weird one because when I was thinking about I got so sick, I was like, do I stop riding? Do I stop the race? And they were like, oh, you do realize if you stop the race, you'd have to ride to somewhere. And I was like, oh, so either way, I've got to carry on riding. So either way, I've got to go back into the mountains. I was like, I may as well carry on.
Sounds intense.
Oh my gosh.
Robin, how are you doing? And what are your plans this year for your ultra endurance calendar?
So my plan, I'm doing well. Sorry, Jack. I'm very good. Well. My plan, I'm going to be riding the Trans Balkans race this year, which is a similar distance, 1,300 kilometers with many meters of climbing. Starts in Slovenia, ends in Montenegro. Yeah, so I'm just kind of training up for that at the moment.
Sounds intense. I will be doing no such things like that this year. I will be dossing in a tent on a tandem and that's about it. Anyway, we'll dive straight into the world of fastest known times. But first and foremost, Molly, what is a fastest known time? At its most basic level.
Yeah, it's kind of self-explanatory. It's the fastest known time for a route. So it has to be like a named route. Mm-hmm. There's parameters around how long it is, what kind of terrain it is, obviously depending on what site you're using. And it's just the record as far as we know. Someone could have done it quicker. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's the fastest that anyone knows has been recorded on that route. And then sometimes someone pops up and says, I've done it quicker. And then they become the fastest known time.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like running in an almost like an individual time trial format, but verified, generally speaking, these days through the likes of Strava.
Yes. Yeah. So it has to be verified through like a GPX file, mm-hmm. a Strava file, something that mm-hmm. proves you did the route and you stuck to the route. And yeah, there wasn't anything weird going on.
Wow.
But yeah, it is just a record for any multi-terrain route in the UK.
So it's become kind of popularized in cycling, I'd say, in the last, you know, I don't know, I'm making a broad assumption, but like 4 or 5 years has become a bit more of a thing. But it's quite an established racing format with more history in the sort of backpacking and through hiking world.
As far as I'm aware, it came from like ultra running, when it mm-hmm. where the kind of the bigger side of it, when it became really popular. And yeah, we kind of thought, that could be a thing in cycling as well. But yeah, it's massive in that sport. It's kind of, if you have a record, that's as big as having a result in a race. They're kind of on a par with each other. If not, some of the fastest known times are bigger than a race mm-hmm. win. So yeah, it's in the early stages in cycling, but in that sport, it's absolutely massive.
And sort of internationally, then, you know, you focus on the UK fastest known times. Are there any sort of equivalent, we'll call them services, looking at fastest known times in other sports or?
In other sports, I think, yeah, there's, especially ultra running, that's worldwide, is absolutely huge. In cycling in America, it's quite big. Mm-hmm. And then here, there's not so much information about Europe. We are trying to expand into Europe, but it's just not as established a thing. So you're working right from the beginning of like, finding a route and then trying to go back on the internet and trawl the social media and try and find some record of someone's time.
So it's now a good time to go to Europe and try and get some FKT.
Yeah,
get
just like go back
and be like, well, I'm so good.
Yeah, you get a hit list. Sounds like a good bike radar series. Yeah. And something I've kind of noticed with these is the fastest known time routes, generally speaking, involve a degree of off-road riding. Is that sort of true generally of FKTs worldwide, or is it just a kind of UK thing that stipulates gravel or off-road riding must be a part of it?
So that was more just our kind of personal choice. It's just that our site has to have a percentage of off-road. There are sites and resources for the road, and kind of there was a lot of debate about that when we launched it, but there was already those resources for road records. So we felt like it doesn't really need any more promotion. Doesn't need the same sort of thing. It also wasn't really my area of riding. I don't read anything about it. I don't do it. So, and the other side, which became something that people talked about, but was that I wasn't comfortable encouraging people to do those. In my opinion, they're dangerous, most of them, because the kind of the way that the road ones work for like en masse is that it's the fastest you could possibly get from point A to point B. So they don't go for like, oh, okay, we'll set a route that's safe and goes on safe roads and is beautiful and goes through the mountains and stuff. And that'll be the record for that route. It's just what is the fastest you could possibly get from point A to point B. So it means it goes on like dual carriageways, main roads, not all of them, but like a majority of them go on really dangerous roads that I personally wouldn't cycle on. And yeah, I felt like if we include those, you are encouraging people then to go and do them. And I wasn't comfortable with doing that. I think if that's someone's personal choice, that's absolutely fine. But yeah, I didn't want to be kind of complicit in that. And then something happens to someone and you feel like you're a part of that then.
You could also argue as well with the road scene,
like time trialing already exists in a much more established, like really old school mentality. Like that's a thing already. This is something quite different. I think the fastest known time scene.
Yeah, it just didn't need any more promotion than it had, I think. Yeah. And kind of it was the growth area we were seeing was in the same with the ultras. Like, okay, there's lots of established road ultras, but again, they're already doing well. That's already a booming scene. It's the kind of the multi-terrain stuff that we wanted to explore a bit more, and it just felt a bit more accessible.
Give us a taste then of some of the routes or courses in the UK that had fastest known times clocked on them.
I'd say the kind of, it's already sort of filtered itself into the big ones and then the rest. Mm-hmm. So the big ones are probably Lakeland 200, that's 206 kilometres around the Lake District, goes over Black Sail and High Street. The Transcam, that's the across Wales, the width of Wales off-road. King Alfred's, that's a big one, that's quite local to Bristol. I'd say the big ones are either the ones that are the grandest routes, like they're massive, they have the most scenery or the most off-road, and they're kind of the most epic or the hardest that there are. Or there's somewhere where there's quite a big population of riders, and then you get it where someone starts going for it. And what we've noticed is that once people start going for it, it just snowballs. So once there's a competition on it, then it just becomes massive. So it almost kind of seeds itself.
The Transcambrian Way. Robin, such fond memories from last year? No, the year before. 2 years ago, we tried to ride it as
Oh, yeah, the time, the relay thing,
relay,
yeah.
Yeah. Do any fond memories you want to recall from that?
So we did a video where we tried to beat Matt Page's insane time, but because none of us are actual real athletes, we split it between three of us and saw whether we could beat him with three of us, and we completely failed. It was so hard. And the main memory is just so many gates. So many gates.
Everyone says that.
Oh my God. You'd be like getting to the flow and then like, oh, another gate. And then you get to the flow again and oh, another gate. It's a very beautiful route, but...
Yeah. It was really good fun. I rode the last third and Felix was the rider before. For me, I had such a good section, but my God, there's so many gates. But also, I rode it fairly quickly that last section, but I just cannot imagine sustaining that effort for that long. It really goes to show that we're not athletes, Robin, compared to Molly.
Absolutely not. And I think also when we looked at his time, his overall stopping time was like 20 minutes over 15 hours. I can't remember the exact stats, but it was something ridiculously small. And I don't know, do you have the same thing where you don't stop like at all?
It does depend on it. So I think on Transcam, I think I stopped for maybe like 15 minutes, something like that.
God.
It depends on the route, depends on the resupply. Like, is it short enough you can carry everything you need? So like for a Transcam, that's short enough that you can set off with all the food and all the drink you're going to have for the whole ride. So your stopping is, I guess, really like the gates. You haven't stopped. And then as long as nothing goes wrong, like a mechanical or anything like that, you try and wear layers, you can take off on the go. I mean, I barely stopped for a gate because I went with having my bike super light and I just chucked the bike over, hopped the gate. So I didn't open a single one. I didn't bother wasting time trying to see if you could open the gate or not and if it was like one that's stuck and you had to lift up. I just climbed them all. So I think there's things where you can just, as long as you have in your mind to not stop, but you do hemorrhage time so quickly. Like you do some rides where you swear you didn't stop and then you upload the file and it's like an hour and a half. And you're like, where did I stop for an hour and a half? Like it's every like 5 minutes, every 10 minutes just adds up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So a lot of it comes down to that. I think when I originally set the Transcam record, the time I was beating, I think she'd stopped for an hour and a half, so I knew I'd beat it if I just didn't stop for that long, so I didn't have to go any quicker. I just had to stop less. So like there's all those kinds of psychology things.
Efficiency is beautiful. I'll put a link to that video in the description. It's a really funny one. I knew that we'd failed towards the end, so there's a good clip of me looking at a slow worm towards the end of it, really not taking it very seriously. We'll come on to as well to a bit more on kind of strategy and tactics, but what are the kind of rules of an FKT? You know, if I'm out there, I want to go and smash myself to bits in the Badger Divide or something, what do I need to do to ensure that I'm sticking within the spirit of the FKT?
There's not very many rules, quite simple. It has to be solo. There are also pairs do things, but we just do solo. It has to be solo, has to be self-supported, and you have to follow the route. Within reason, if something, they're obviously like living, breathing routes, there's not loads of control over them. People occasionally, something happens and you physically can't, it's too dangerous, they've closed a section. So you can divert around, but there has to be like evidence of that and why you've done that. But in general, yeah, you just can't have any outside support at all. You have to do it all under your own steam and things that are commercially available. So you can't have like water drops and you can't have things that you've placed out there before. And it has to be solo. And that's kind of it. So you can just go and do it on your own. And that's then you've done it. There's lots of debate around like little nitpicky things about rules. But we kind of go for that's the blanket thing. We had it recently where someone went into the Lakeland and they'd ridden it technically with someone, but they hadn't ever drafted them, and they got into debate, and it was like, nope, that's not solo. That's there's just black and white rules. We don't get into debating stuff. We just get into like, okay, these are the rules. There's not very many of them. That's it.
It's really funny looking at it through the lens of, because that's how I've understood FKTs. There's a really good book, Hamish Brown's Big Walk, and he was the first mountaineer to walk the Scottish Munro around. So it's every Munro in Scotland doing it in one go. It was really interesting and had run up to his thing. He like drove around the country and buried loads of food everywhere.
Yeah.
Because like, bear in mind, this was in like the 60s, or I think it was 60s or 70s. I think probably less well resourced in terms of kit, much heavier, whatever. But like you read it and the ethics of it on the face of it, you're like, that's mad. What's he doing? So I'm very pleased that things have been simplified in that regard. So if I've gone out and I've smashed myself to bits on this route, how do I then validate a route with you, for example?
So you can go onto the website, Fastest Known Times. There's like a contact form. You send it in just with a file, link to a Strava. Please make it public. The amount of private Stravas you get sent and then they don't let us follow them, and there's like pretty useless. So either that or just the GPX file, like a raw file is fine. We get quite a lot in the DMs. It's preferable not to, just because they get lost in like the requests and in the other stuff you have in there. But if that's how you want to do it, then yeah, on Instagram. And yeah, just a ride file. If there's any anomalies, an explanation for the anomalies. And then we can kind of make a decision about whether it's valid or not.
Practically speaking, like, how do you actually validate? Are you looking at the sort of track, or do you have, dare I ask, a bit like software that compares it, or is it purely manual?
Manual. So you overlay, like right with GPS, we've got the raw map, the like the set route for the record, and then you just overlay the file. And 99% of the time, it's just an exact copy. I mean, maybe there's a tiny bit of GPS drift, but yeah, that's normal. And then sometimes there's an anomaly, but normally it's that there's like a road closure or something. I think we've only had it once where there was someone who had just gone wrong and you have to be like, I'm really sorry. You went wrong and you missed a bit of the route. And it feels harsh because they probably did the same amount overall, but there has to be kind of just a blanket, this is the rule. You kind of can't get into how much percent did you miss, how was it easier what you rode, because we can't go out and check all of that. So yeah, just overlay it on the ride with GPS file.
How do you kind of, if people go out on e-bikes and things like that, can you work out if they've done that? Or
I guess not. I think a lot of it is on trust, like anything. I think the same in ultra races to a large extent. If you really wanted to cheat, you probably could, because you're not being followed the whole time. There's not cameras out there. Even if you're in an event, there's not people watching you at all times. But even more so on an FKT, there's a lot of just trust put in it, because we're not out there with you checking that you're not having a partner come and hand you water or something. Like, there's loads of stuff you could do, but you just kind of have to have it on faith that people wouldn't do that. I mean, there's kind of nothing to gain from that, I guess, like any cheating. But no, I think, I mean, it'd be fairly obvious if someone had done that, I guess, because it would just be too good. There's a certain point where it's just too far out the realm of possibility. People also normally send us photos, so they'd have to be swapping bikes out for photos and stuff. I just think it would be, I mean, it could happen.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The world isn't wide enough. Get immersed in the expansive views of the 48-inch customizable panoramic display in the all-new 2024 Lincoln Nautilus Hybrid. Explore more at Lincoln.com. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.
You mentioned cameras there. Something I was quite interested to grill you on. Just a little bit tasty controversy. You know, certainly in higher profile races, there's been a lot of talk about media support, more than anything else, about media coming along and creating content off the back of these record attempts. Makes for very good, interesting content. But what's your sort of view on how that impacts, we'll call it the ethics or the purity of an attempt?
I love having this conversation, so thank you for bringing this up. I love this debate raging on. We've gone for the approach of, if it's not tangible objective, support, then we don't really care. I think once you get into the grey areas and the, was it moral support, was it psychological support, you then get into questioning every little tiny thing about it. Like, can you ring your partner while you're on it? Can someone text you saying like, oh, you're doing really well? Like, whatever the thing is. Oh, I think just it's too much to control. And I think there's a danger of sucking all the joy out of something that at the end of the day is meant to be fun. This is all made up stuff. This is made up competition, like all competition. This is all just someone's invented this and gone, oh, this would be cool to do. And I think once you get into, God, nobody can give you any moral support. No one can come and be there for you. No one can give you any joy while you're out on the route. You're in that bit of like, oh, okay, so we're just going to suck every bit of fun out of this thing. That actually there's nothing to gain from doing this well, other than just it should bring you happiness and other people should enjoy watching it. And I guess I can see the point of view of its moral support. I would argue probably it is. Probably you do get a bit of a boost from seeing someone, depending on what kind of person you are. Some people hate having people out there with them. Some people hate having the pressure of, oh my God, there's someone watching this and I have to do well. So I think it kind of falls into two camps of kind of what kind of person you are. But there's a difference between objective benefit, like, okay, you've cut the route short, or you've used an e-bike, or you've left stuff out on the route for you so you haven't had to stop. Like, that is just cheating. You've given yourself a tangible advantage. Once we're debating something, it means it's not certain that it gives you a benefit anyway. And also, no one's going to see any of this if you don't have people out there telling stories and following people's stories and that kind of thing. But I do understand the debate around it. I just don't really care. I just think life's too short. And I just, I have the argument pops up all the time, and it pops up in the DMs, pops up in comments. And I'm just really tired of having the argument, because it's one of those things of, once you drill into the things of like, oh, but is that person getting an advantage? It's then like, this isn't fair, you know? Like, you're born with talent. You're born into a wealthy family where you get good food and you get a good upbringing and you have supportive people around you and you have a better bike and you didn't have to work that week. You have a job that's flexible and someone drove you to the start of it. And so, you know, you're getting into like, how do you make this actually fair? Outside of kind of the things that are black and white, this was a benefit and this wasn't, this was cheating and this wasn't, you get into like, oh, do you do a sliding scale? Do you look into someone's like background? Like, oh, okay, so where should you fit? Where should I give you a time bonus or penalty because of your kind of what support you got, that's this gray area of like, was it support? Was it not support? And I just think we've kind of, in the argument around whether having someone take a photo of you out on the route, we've kind of lost sight of the fact that like, that is a drop in the ocean of how unfair this actually is. It doesn't matter. Like, we've had it before where someone argued because someone went out on the route and took like 3 photos of someone and they're like, it should be not counting. You're like, oh, like, really? So where's the line in this? Like, you go past your house and yeah, your partner or your brother or whoever steps out the door and like cheers you on and says, well done. Is that too much? Like, just where's the line of support? And yeah, we just went with, let's just dodge the argument completely and let's just not really take a stand on it, which is, if it doesn't break the rules, if it's not objective, tangible support or cheating, then we just don't really get involved with it.
Sounds healthy to me. Less puritanical approach. Do you have any views on it, Robin?
No, I was just nodding along because I was like, that's very refreshing to hear that. Like, to hear that it's all about the fun and like, you know, obviously it's nice to have somebody come out and support you and like, yeah, you're right. How can you tell what's fair at the start line, because everyone's come on their own journeys, haven't they? So yeah, very refreshing.
Yeah. We kind of do stipulate they can't break any of the rules themselves. They can't give you anything.
Yeah.
They can't share any information. They can't tell you what's coming up on the trailer. They've been there. They can't give you weather information. So they can't do anything that is actually breaking one of the rules themselves. So they can come and be there, but they can't draft, all that sort of stuff. And as far as enforcing that, it's the same as everything else. You just trust that people will stick to that rule.
You'd have to be a real spoil sport to cheat at an FKT. Yeah, like, yeah. Just think of all the things, like the shame if you were found out. You know, road cycling, whatever. Yeah. He was a doper. Ah, who cares? Let him back in. But FKT, the community will shun you forever.
Oh yeah, you'll never be able to show your face on Instagram ever again.
Oh no.
Yeah, the Instagram side of things. It's the greatest Instagram flex of all time, I think, posting an FKT. It's good. So what kind of routes, you know, we talked briefly on the UK side, like what routes make up the map of FKT routes in the UK? Is it all 2,000 kilometre long sufferfests, or are there more accessible options?
No, it starts like relatively short, in quotation marks. We want them to be ultra endurance. There's no real defined definition of what that means, but you've got to set some sort of a benchmark. So we've gone with 150K. It used to be a bit longer because we used to just do it off the like shortest route we had. And then it kind of, as people pitched other routes, people developed routes, as people went at road stuff, we just went with, okay, what seems to be that minimum entry point to where people like will view it as an ultra thing? And then the level of off-road only has to be 20%. It's pretty low. It just eliminated road effectively. We didn't want it to be that it had to be yet. 90% mountain bike, you were hiking for hours, it took you days. But we just effectively want to eliminate road and make it that really by the time you get to 20%, that's going to be a multi-terrain route. You're not going to put 20% in a road route and have people just have to get a gravel bike for that. So that kind of just meant, okay, it's ultra, it's long enough to be that, and it's multi-terrain. So yeah, 150k and 20%.
Any routes you quite fancy having a crack at, Robin? Anything for an FKT attempt?
You know, I'm not very fast.
That's not true. I've seen your Strava.
I rode the King Alfred's Way a couple of years ago and I loved it and I thought that would be really fun. Who's got the record for it? They did it in like 15 hours or something.
Oh, yeah, Molly,
it was Molly. And I was like, that is absolutely mad. It took me like 4 days. I don't know how you did it that fast. So yeah.
What's been your favourite route in the UK of this mix?
Lakeland 200.
Yeah.
I have the most like soft spot for the Transcam just because I grew up in the area. My parents live in the area. My dad was on like one of the two people who helped map it and stuff. So it just has like, it feels more connected to me. Mm. But actually it's the Lakeland 200 is my favourite. Like it's just, there's something about that route that it's just so massive that, yeah. And it's one where I've had the record twice. And both times I went into it thinking like, it's maybe 50-50, I'll get it. Like that's the one where I had the least certainty I'd get it. But I was like, oh, the payoff if you don't get it is still, the silver lining is pretty massive because it's just such an incredible just route to be on, regardless of how you do it.
That's quite a mountain bikey route, isn't it? Like it's mostly single track trail. Yeah.
I mean, you hike quite a lot. You hike Blacksail and you hike High Street. So you hike for hours on it. But yeah, I rode it on a hardtail both times, but it would be quicker on a full sus. It's very painful by the end. You're just like, oh my God, I need more suspension. But that is pretty rough. I mean, like anything, you could ride it on other bikes if you wanted to, but it would be quite uncomfortable. So yeah, that I would say that's a mountain bike one. Yeah.
I'm sure there's some like hardened Lakeland gravel person who's like, I'd ride it on a gravel bike.
Yeah. There's always someone I'm like, yeah, you could. I wouldn't. But
this is gravel, obviously. Yeah.
In terms of strategy, like this is a really broad question because obviously no route's the same, but like, what would be your sage advice to anyone having a crack at an FKT?
Oh God, I guess it depends which one it is. I mean, pacing is always the really obvious one. Even the kind of shorter ones are still sort of like, what, 8 hours? 6-8 hours? Something like that is the shortest. That's like a really short one. Most of the time you're looking at over 12, maybe over 20. So yeah, pacing. Knowing the route is really important. You can lose a lot of time on missed turns and making mistakes. And it all adds up, like we were saying about stopping, that actually you think, oh, I didn't go wrong that much. And then over the course of however, like 20 hours, let's say, that adds up to quite a lot. Efficiency, not stopping a lot, trying to kind of cut down on your stoppage time. So planning food, planning all that sort of stuff. But actually mostly just have fun. The only ones for me that have either I've not got them or they've gone wrong, I just haven't really been enjoying them. I've kind of got too much in my head about it. It's been too much about like breaking a record or whatever. So just go out and like have fun on a route and just see what happens. Because actually it's really low stakes. If you don't get it, you don't get it. There's not a massive investment. That's kind of one of the good things that's different to events and stuff is that you can just pick a day and go and do it. And it's pretty much free. Okay, you might have to get to the start of something. But now there's routes all over the country. So you won't have to go very far to get to an FKT route. And then if you don't get it, you just kind of go, oh, okay. And then you just move on. And you can go again the next week. When I did the Transcam double, I didn't get it. And then I went back a week and a half later and I got it. It's just low stakes, which is nice. There's not so much pressure on it. So don't put the pressure on yourself.
And Robin, from your experience riding the Bright Midnight, any sage ultra endurance advice you'd like to pass on? Apart from cucumbers being the ultimate cycling route.
My main one is don't take kit that is already kind of worn out because it will fall apart on you. You don't want that to happen.
What was the kind of worst point there in terms of your kit?
I had a bar bag on the front, which I'd used a lot of times and I loved it, but it was quite old and it did start letting water in when it started raining every day. And that was my sleeping bag got wet. So that was very horrible. So don't do that.
Yeah, that sounds really, really grim.
Similar to that is check your kit before you go. Because in Atlas, I got there and I had like a pump on my bike, just a mini pump that I thought worked well. I hadn't checked it, but I assumed it worked well. And then my mate borrowed it the day before and he pulled it like apart to start pumping up and it just snapped in two in his hands.
Oh, God.
I was like, oh, I should have checked that before I came to Morocco.
Were you pumpless then for the Atlas Mount or did you buy one?
No, so I didn't have time to buy one because it was starting the next. Well, I guess I could have gone out and tried to get one, but I'd bought with me to unpack my bike, like a mini floor pump. So I just took that. So I had the most I was going to be so smug if I got a puncture there while everyone else is like there with a little mini pump and I'm there with this little floor pump. And it had a little like fold down kickstand and stuff.
Oh,
like,
amazing.
So I just took that. It's one of those things where I just go with the flow. I couldn't be bothered to have any more mental stress, so I just went with it.
That's nice. That's really, really good. But think of the time savings you would have made if you had got a puncture.
Yeah, I almost wanted one just to use my bike.
Just for the tech nerds in the room, what did you ride for Atlas Mountain Race? I'm desperate to know. It's my lifeblood.
I rode Norbea Oyth, so like an XC bike. 120 travel front and back. It's a debatable one, hardtail, full sus. I think it's about 50-50, and then a few nutters on a gravel bike thrown in there just for good measure. But yeah, I think it's one where comfort is king, especially over that distance. You're getting tired. Like the impact from your body is a massive amount of fatigue is coming up through the bike. And a lot of the descents are on the verge of rideable on a hardtail, I'd argue. So, well, I mean, you can ride them, but it's how much risk there is in that. Mm. So yeah, I went full sus, and that's what I would recommend to people if they have one, if not hardtail. And if you really want a gravel bike.
The risk aspect of it, like, this is probably a daft question, but like, how do you temper your riding to sort of manage the level of risk when you are very, very tired?
I think if I ever think, oh, should I be riding this? I get off. Because there's a lot of things where, okay, you can maybe ride them. It's like things where you get to them and you think like, oh yeah, I can probably ride this. Yeah, when you're fresh and you haven't got a fully loaded bike and yeah, you're not however many days deep in sleep deprivation. And also, it's not all about can you ride it in terms of am I going to crash? It's also am I going to get a puncture? Am I going to slit a sidewall? So some people go for they ride as much as is physically possible. And that's one tactic. It's probably quicker, but it's a bit riskier because, yeah, if you get a mechanical, if you damage your bike or something, or if you crash, that's race over. So normally I'll kind of, as I go into something, normally a descent, I'll just, in that, you always have that flicker in your mind. Like your subconscious always tells you that you think like, oh, should I be riding this? Like it does cross your mind in that split second. And whereas if I was just on a ride, you'd probably just go, yeah, all right, we'll see what happens. It's just that thing of, yeah, thinking a bit more cautiously of, okay, it might save me 20 seconds. It might save me a minute. But if it then costs you the whole race because you've broken your bike or you've broken your leg or whatever's happened, it's kind of, is that payoff worth it? Probably not.
I was going to ask, you must have lots of experience with like sleeplessness. Mm-hmm. What is your advice for that?
I'm quite a big sleeper, so I don't tend to. I used to be someone who went straight through. In like the early days of my ultra racing, I'd go through at least a night. I'd go through two sometimes. But it's that thing where you do it and then you go, oh, this is stupid. It's really bad for your health. It's really dangerous. It may mean you don't enjoy it as much. So I've kind of grown out of that phase of my riding. And now I sleep in ultra terms a fair bit, but it's about kind of listening to your body and also not trying to compare yourself to what other people can do, because some people can have 2 hours in a night and they function like much better the next day. They're still going to be like obviously cognitively impaired and it's still not good for them, but they could actually ride all right on that. I'm someone who doesn't ride great on sleep deprivation, so it's kind of finding where you sit and like how much is actually the best for you in terms of first, like, yeah, mitigating risk, but also actually, are you quicker or are you so much worse at riding then that you're way slower anyway, so you may as well have slept? And just finding your own comfort zone with it. I think there's kind of a lot of pressure, especially if you're kind of a racer who wants to go there for a result. It's a lot of pressure not to sleep because the top people aren't sleeping, but it's actually doing what's best for you and your riding and your body. And knowing what you're willing to sacrifice for it, we kind of don't know what the long-term impacts of that are. And I decided quite early on that I wasn't willing to take that risk with my kind of health. So yeah, I think listening to your body and do sleep. Even if it's a bit, do sleep. Also sleep earlier. Like people quite often will miss the first night or they'll be like, oh, okay, I'll really push it at the start and then I'll sleep a bit more at the end. But you can't really salvage it. Once you've gone too far, it's hard to pull it back. Mm. So if you are really exhausted, like night one, then sleep from the start, but sleep consistently a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think in Transpyrenees last year, I ended up around a guy who I know quite well and I'd gone for, I'm going to sleep consistently a kind of middling amount, whereas he went for, I reckon I can get through the first night and probably most of the second night, and then I'll start sleeping. But once you're that deep in the red, you can't really bring it back. You're just suffering then. And your body's already kind of started to shut down a bit. Oh, wow. So he ended up kind of dropping down the rankings a fair bit in that latter stages. And I passed him out on the road. I was like, God, he looks awful. And he was like, oh, how are you okay? And I was like, because I've slept from the start. So I'm actually like, I've just kept the consistency. So I'd say like, that's better than going for like, I'll push through however long and then I'll start doing it. It's kind of just a little bit. Nice. Every night, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any, like, I'm so sorry, I'm going to ask such a boring techie question. Like, data-wise, do you, like, look at power or heart rate? Or is there any sort of data-led decision-making in your racing?
Not in mine. I don't have any. I don't have, like, a power meter or a heart rate monitor. Just vibes, yeah. I don't think many people go off power. I think it'd be pretty redundant in ultra. Quite a lot go off heart rate, typically to not overdo it at the start. But actually, once you're like, however many days, 2 or 3 days into it, it becomes kind of irrelevant because you're just trying to like salvage whatever you've got left. There's not, I mean, your heart rate is going to be all over the place because your body is massively under pressure and distressed, and you can't, without days off the bike, you can't really put that right. I don't really find that beneficial for me. Mentally speaking, I'm sure like it would have its benefits from like a practical sense, but kind of the part of cycling I come from, like I retired not on the best terms and not in the best relationship with cycling. So I kind of focus on just how I feel and what I want to do and how I want to ride. And that's much better for me than kind of getting bogged down in numbers and training and power and output and kind of analysing stuff to the extreme. I'm much better off just having fun and seeing where it goes.
But it's been successful as well. I think it's interesting. Your background is quite unusual in that, yeah, you have come from that much more data analytical led side of road racing into this. But, you know, it's clearly working for you to not look at that. You're a very successful racer. So, yeah.
I feel like I have the benefit of the history with it. Like, I kind of know my body quite well. It's quite easy to go off feel if you already know what stuff feels like. It's all well and good telling somebody who's like new to riding, just go off feel. But if you don't have anything to compare it to, whereas actually, like, I was trained for years. So I'd have people like, oh, do you have a coach? Well, no, because I can kind of just make it up because I've had coaches. I've had loads of different coaches, loads of different training plans. And the same with kind of going off RPE, like rate of perceived exertion in efforts and stuff. I just kind of can guess what stuff feels like. So you can get it there or thereabouts. And in ultra racing, things aren't coming down to margins of like tenths of seconds. And like, you know, you're winning or losing by like a photo finish or an inch or whatever it is. And that the margins are tiny between each rider. Kind of, there's so many things happening. There's so many things outside of the riding that matter more. Like how you are mentally in a race is so often more important than how you are physically. So kind of lean into what works for you from that perspective.
When you did the Bright Midnight, was there any sort of low points? Apart from when your sleeping bag was wet.
There was one low point. It was like on the evening or like probably like night four, and it was pouring with rain, soaked through. I was with another guy as well, and like we were basically, that was like this swamp that we had to like hike through, and it was the middle of the night and we were just like hiking through this swamp like, and it was pouring, and like we were just, you know, just in a bad place. We hadn't, because it had been raining so much, and like there were obviously, because it was in Norway, there wasn't anywhere to stop for food, so we hadn't been able to stop and really eat anything. So yeah, you know, when you're kind of a bonking stage as well, and you're like, oh, just why am I here? But then you kind of get, I kind of think I got a bit hysterical, you know, when you're just like, this is hilarious. What am I doing? Yeah.
Nice. Just to come back to sort of the phenomena aspect of this, like, why do you think, I'll ask you both in turn, why do you think FKTs have become so popular? Like, what's behind all the hype from your point of view, Marley?
I guess like the accessibility of the competition side of it. I think there's a lot of barriers to entry anyway in any sport, but obviously in cycling it's like that is a bit bigger. And then in events you've got kind of the cost, you've got the time, you've got that it happens in a specific moment in a year that you have to be ready for. Whereas I think the fact that this, you can just go and do one when you fancy it. There's not kind of so many barriers to it. Anyone theoretically can go and do an FKT. I think there's something about that. It's also a bit purer. I think people like the fact that it's kind of a time trial type thing. There's not really so much of that in the kind of multi-terrain ultra world. There aren't really time trials and things. So for a lot of people, they don't really thrive off being in a big group environment at an ultra. You can also just go and take yourself off and do an FKT. I think the, not to like make it about the fact that we made the site, but I think the fact there is a leaderboard, the fact that is like people know what the times are, they know what the routes are, kind of part of the reason we set it up in lockdown as a bit of like a passion project thing was that we were kind of like, why isn't this as big in cycling? Why isn't there FKTs? Why aren't they a huge part of multi-terrain like ultra stuff? And a lot of people are like, oh yeah, because if you don't know what the time is and you don't know what the route is and no one knows they exist, then no one's going to do them. So I think the fact that now there is that like resource for it. I guess then as people then go and do records, people kind of buy into it. People get sucked into wanting to go and beat the time. And then as more and more people do it, it's one of those like snowball effect things where, yeah, the more attention it gets, the more people want to ride them, the more people want to see them. Yeah.
And it's very prestigious, you know, if someone gets an FKT, you're like, oh my God, they are, you know, they are an athlete.
Yeah. Do you think that is the kind of key reason behind it, the prestige that Molly's built with the website?
I mean, part of it is the prestige, but like you were saying, it is really accessible and much more so than like doing like a big race. And I think probably if you've just got something you want to train up for that's not as big as an ultra, then like, yeah, it's like a good thing to aim for.
What's next for you this year then, Molly? What else is on the cards, either in your ultra endurance world, or maybe you'll give us a sneaky peek on any of the FKTs you'd like to tackle the rest of the year? It's only spring.
Yeah, that's true. I know, it feels late because of Atlas. Mm. Like, it throws your year off a bit. Yeah, I'm doing Transcon this year. So that's kind of a big anchor event, I guess, because that's just so huge and scary that you kind of have to build your year around that. But in May, I'm doing like a Catalonian Ultra, Cronvejorge, just to like get ready for Transcon. And then I'll race Trans Pyrenees again after Transcon. But they're kind of secondary to that because you have to put everything into that one, really. And then in terms of FKTs, the only one I have on the cards kind of pretty definitely is the Lakeland 200 again. I want to get the women's record under 20 hours, hopefully under 19. We'll see if that's possible. But I've got a bit of a project like built around that. And then other than that, I just kind of slot them in as and when I find a bit of a window where I want to go and have an adventure.
Sounds cool.
Wow. That's amazing. What are your plans for the Transcon?
Well, I haven't made any yet, but okay. I probably should start making them. Well, I'm in the kind of the very early stages of mapping because you map the vast majority of it yourself.
Yeah.
And what I learned from Trans Pyrenees last year, where I got injured just before it, so I wasn't sure I was going to ride it. So I kind of left the mapping until the last minute, and then I kind of just let Komoot and Ride with GPS do it for me. And you lost so much time from people who'd really studied the mapping. Mm. They'd kind of like, they'd gain half an hour in no time because they'd found little like squirrely back roads that could cut off some bits of the route. There'd be people that you knew were definitely behind you, and then you just carry on the same road. Then they'd pop out like ahead of you, and you think, where did you go? How have you got there? So I think a lot of it is just focusing on that and making sure you kind of capitalize on all the little sneaky cut throughs and stuff.
Cool.
What a cool race. Like, what an amazing adventure. I'm sure you have an epic time in the quite literal sense of the word.
Wow.
So with the website fkt.org.uk, I went and checked while we were going through there. How popular is it? Like, how big has it become for you as part of your life, but also just how big is the website?
I mean, it's a lot bigger than we ever thought it would become. We kind of thought it would be one of those, a bit of a side project. We'd dip in and out of it. But now in the patches where it's FKT season, so we found it at the very end of what we class as winter, we kind of thought, not many people have gone for a winter one. And then it was like one a day. And we were like, okay. And it was just constant. People were breaking one, then someone else was breaking it the next day. And you were going, God, better put that one up quickly because it's already been beaten. And then in summer, once it hits the season, yeah, you're getting multiple a week, and that's just the people who break them. You don't hear about the people who tried one and didn't. We had one where I think three people broke it over a weekend, two people in the same day. So someone set it, this is on King Alfred's Way, someone set it, and then 2 hours later, they didn't know they were on it at the same time. Someone else finished, and they'd beaten them.
Funny. Oh, that's so horrible!
And it was by like no time at all. It was by like a minute and 20 seconds or something stupid like amount of time. But they didn't even know they were out there with each other. But kind of the thing that I find more fascinating is all the people who try and you never know. So someone I was at Atlas with, I was saying like, I wonder who goes for them and just never tells anyone. And he'd gone for Transcam 3 times. And I'm like, if you've gone for that 3 times, I'm wondering how many people have gone for them. And then just like, kind of brush that under the carpet. Yeah. Which is kind of why we started setting up leaderboards, is that we don't want it to be like, you either got it or you didn't. And it's like this sort of like success or failure thing. We thought, if we put a leaderboard, there's more motivation to go and try. Because you could still end up second or third. And hopefully people will actually say, I went and did it, not kind of just pretend it never happened.
Honestly, it's a good website. It's really well laid out. It's really easy and accessible. It's just good fun to kind of click through, see everybody's rides, where they've added them. Yeah, it's a nice one to sort of dream of summer plans ahead.
No like kudos on building the website. So I'll just put out there, I did nothing.
Thank you very, very much for coming on. It was great, and all the best for your big season ahead. If you have any questions that you want to ask us, maybe we'll do a follow-up on sort of other ultra endurance racing formats in the future. Send any questions to podcast@bikeradar.com. In the meantime, thank you very, very much for listening, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you've not done so already, please subscribe and share with your friends, or leave us a rating if you've enjoyed this episode.